This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
It is hard to know if the ultimate threats to our existence are real. A small group of people, including a couple of scientists, say humans will go extinct this century. The cause, they say, is a complex of climate disaster, social meltdown, and then multiple nuclear meltdowns. Most of the scientists on Radio EcoShock agree climate-driven disasters will emerge in multiple forms, but they expect humans will continue. In this program, we will interview a scientist who just shed more light on why mass extinctions happen and the thresholds that precede them. It's cutting-edge science, but spoiler alert, if you are expecting to witness the end in your lifetime, you may be disappointed. Then we are off to the dense forests of Indonesia and the vast palm plantations that are replacing them. It's a tale of corruption, and many of the products you buy contain at least some palm oil. Others burn it to generate electricity, claiming it is green energy. And now, with an in-depth investigation by Monga Bay, we find out what it really costs. If you don't care about that, care about this. With little industry or transportation, Indonesia still edges into the number three spot as a huge source of greenhouse gases, at times behind only China and the United States. That matters. I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. Are we headed for a sixth mass extinction? Experts are asking, and a new paper from MIT brings us some more answers. The possible cause of ecological collapse may surprise you. Here to explain is the author Daniel H. Rothman. He is a professor of geophysics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Rothman is also co-director with Kerry Emanuel of the Lorenz Center at MIT. From Cambridge, Massachusetts, Daniel, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you here. I've been wanting to talk to you for a while, actually. Now, some biologists say that we are entering a mass extinction, and I've spoken with climate scientists right here on Radio EcoShock that worry about that, too. You and a half dozen other scientists tackled that question in 2015, but for reasons that I hadn't heard before, please explain how a change in microbial life could do us in.
Okay. You're referring to an earlier paper of mine.
Yes.
And this is a paper that appeared in PNAS. And it suggested that the end-Permian extinction, which occurred about 251 million years ago, may have been aided by the evolution of a specific microbe that had the ability to efficiently metabolize a certain form of organic matter and turn it into methane.
All right, but we've been hearing mostly on the past extinctions about macro events like asteroid hits and volcanic eruptions. Are you saying that those are less important, or is this something that you're adding to that discussion?
It's probably the case that the general public thinks that an impact by an extraterrestrial object is the typical cause of mass extinctions. And that's because there is one instance, the extinction at the end of the Cretaceous that gave rise to the extinction of that killed the dinosaurs, has been shown to be the result of an impact with a bolide. However, none of the other major extinctions have been associated with that kind of evidence. So I think it's fair to say now, 30 to 40 years after the discovery of the possible cause of the KT extinction, that other effects are irrelevant. Indeed, the other effects that are probably most commonly discussed today are also relevant to the one at the end of the Cretaceous, and that's the influence of massive volcanism. We now know, due to some very sophisticated studies in high-resolution geochronology in the last several years, that major episodes of volcanism are associated with at least three of the so-called Big Five mass extinctions. That's the one at the end of the Cretaceous, the one at the end of the Triassic, and the one at the end of the Permian. So the work of mine that you're referring to set out in part to understand how it is that such a major volcanic event might give rise to mass extinction.
Now, to grasp your newly published science, I think we are going to need a lesson on the role of respiration in the carbon cycle. It's something that I find difficult to grasp. Could you give us the basics in that?
Sure. My recent paper in Science Advances that you're referring to is indeed based on how the carbon cycle works. And one can think of the carbon cycle as being a kind of loop. Plants take CO2 out of the atmosphere or the oceans, and they make organic matter. And animals consume that organic matter and use oxygen in the process, usually using oxygen. And bacteria can use other oxidants. And in the process of the metabolism of the organic matter, they return the CO2 to the environment. This back reaction, the return of CO2 to the environment, is known in physiology as respiration. So the carbon cycle is a loop between photosynthesis on the one hand, which takes the CO2 out of the system, and respiration, which returns it back.
Right. So we're talking about your new paper, Thresholds of Catastrophe in the Earth System. It was published in the journal Science Advances in September 2017. And, you know, animal life as we know it began with the Cambrian explosion about 500 million years ago, but less than 100 million years later, 86% of all those species were wiped out in a mass extinction event. Does your paper address some of those causes? I mean, why did it happen?
My paper doesn't address the cause of the end Ordovician extinction, which I believe you're referring to. So there are commonly thought to be the five biggest extinctions are commonly thought to be the ones at the end of the Ordovician, at the end of the Devonian, that's about 400 million years ago, and then the other three that I mentioned earlier. In fact, my paper doesn't really provide the causes of any of these. Instead, what it does is that it points out that, let me backtrack a moment, it sets out to answer a simple question. And the simple question is posed by two basic observations. The first observation is that every time we've seen a major mass extinction, the big five that I just referred to, we know, without any doubt, that there has been associated with it a major disruption of Earth's carbon cycle. That, in a sense, is one of the great achievements of the Earth sciences in the last several decades. Another great achievement of the Earth sciences in the last several decades is the observation that there are a great many perturbations of the carbon cycle throughout geologic time. These often give rise to periods of climate change, as has been detailed in many instances. Now, there's on the order of a few dozen major perturbations of the carbon cycle. When there's a mass extinction, there's always one. However, there's a great many others for which there is no mass extinction. So a natural question to ask is what sets the two groups apart, basically the benign events from the malign events. And so that's what I tried to show. And I did that by analyzing in some detail the ways in which the carbon cycle behaved for all of these events, and 31 in total.
And part of that cycle is carbon stored in the deep ocean, and it's not something we normally think about. I mean, we're interested in what's in the atmosphere. And so how does the deep ocean carbon get into this picture?
In an interesting way. You're right that we don't normally think of carbon in the deep ocean. So the deep ocean actually, compared to the atmosphere, contains vastly more carbon, about 50 times more carbon than the atmosphere contains. And then sediments contain much, much more than that. So a particular form of that carbon interested me in performing both of the studies that you're referring to. And that's the carbon that's basically locked up in the ocean and in organic matter and in sediments as organic matter. That is a consequence of the forward reaction of the carbon cycle, the conversion of CO2 into plant matter. It turns out that some of that plant matter just endures nearly forever. That is, the carbon cycle of this loop that I described before is not entirely, it's not an entirely closed loop. There's a little bit that leaks out, a very tiny amount, but that tiny amount is environmentally very significant. It ends up sitting around in the ocean for upwards of about 5,000 years, and there's another bit that ends up in sediments for, you know, millions and millions of years. It just, you know, waits for a large tectonic, cycle to result in its uplift back into rocks, in which it's then remobilized back into the system. So the upshot is that there's this slow pool of carbon, which is effectively reactive, but it reacts at some, you know, a very slow rate for reasons that we don't really understand. And so both papers basically contain within them the assumption that it's possible to remobilize this pool.
And that would be dangerous for us all if it happened. Do you think that human emissions of carbon or our stimulations of carbon through agriculture and all the things that we do could have any role in stimulating a release of that long-held carbon?
That's an interesting question. It's not so easy to make such an extrapolation of these ideas. Remember that we're talking about organic matter that's locked up in the deep ocean. The oceans are voluminous, and to actually make contact with all that organic matter would not only take a new process, but it would take a lot of time, and that's certainly also true for the sediments. So human influence, I don't think you can expect it to have any direct impact on these pools. However, it could have an indirect impact. That is, it could stimulate some other process which could then be responsible for changing the size of these pools.
Well, it's interesting. In your paper, you say, quote, an unstable trajectory would reach its maximum extent roughly 10 to the fourth years after the threshold is breached. And that sounds like the extinction process could be triggered, but we'd still have tens of thousands of years left for human civilization. So what's the worry?
I didn't say we should be worried about that. I don't think I mentioned worry at all in the paper. So the issue in the paper basically addresses how the carbon cycle works. And so there's this question that one can ask, which I think is a very natural question to ask, is the carbon cycle stable? You know, so let's take, you know, the idea you mentioned in your previous question. Suppose we stimulate the system somehow, unknowingly, you know, we make some change. Are we sure that the carbon cycle is going to go on its own merry path independent of that? My suggestion in the paper is that no, we can't be sure. And basically, the analysis doesn't really focus on mechanisms of such stimulation, but it basically asks what conditions lead to a carbon cycle that is unstable. And I developed those ideas in the paper, and they are the ones that then lead to the expression of critical thresholds. And those critical thresholds basically act as, you know, what in physical science we would call a stability boundary. So on one side of this boundary, the system is stable. That's the one that we think we have now. And on the other side, it appears unstable.
Okay. So the key question then is, what are these critical boundaries, and would we know if we'd crossed one?
So let's first talk about what the critical boundaries are. So this is the main crux of the paper. Right. One of them has long been hypothesized, and that's the following. It's long been thought, going back to the earliest days in which people, you know, theorized about mass extinction, and I would date that back to the 18th century. Right. The idea is that the environment changes too fast for ecosystems to keep up with. Right. So that implicitly suggests that there is a critical rate of change. Beyond that critical rate is not a good thing, right? So if you study the geologic past, what you find out is that, well, you know, this is, you know, possibly true, but then what is that critical rate? And so one of the contributions of my paper is to identify that critical rate, and it comes through a combination of theoretical reasoning and building of a database and analyzing the data. But that's only part of the puzzle, because now if we try to ask ourselves, you know, as you said earlier, should we worry about this? And when I say we and worry, that I'm basically saying, well, there's a human time scale. Let's define a human time scale to be on the order of centuries. And on the order of centuries, does the rate really matter? So let's imagine that we even make that an even tighter period. Let's say during this discussion, the carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere go up by a few parts per million. You know, we will hang up our phones. Your listeners will go back and outside after being inside, and they will not notice at all. The carbon dioxide levels will have gone up a few ppm, and no organism will notice the difference. However, the rate of change, that is the amount by which it increased divided by the time over which it changed, would be astronomical compared to any event in the geologic past. So does that mean that we should really care about the rate? And it means, no, that we shouldn't if we're concerned with a very short event. And so that the idea in the paper, which is proposed, is that for short events, what matters is the amount of the change rather than the rate of the change. So I was referring earlier to an effectively infinite rate, but it's not dangerous because it's of only a small amount. And then the paper goes a little bit further because, you know, there's this question of a critical rate at long time scales and then a critical size or amount at short time scales. And the question really is, how does one identify them? So what the paper does is it derives a relation between those two. It shows how to predict the critical size of a fast perturbation from the critical rate of a slow perturbation given one other quantity, and that quantity is the time scale at which changes are damped out by the carbon cycle. And that leads to a very simple relation, and the paper finds the critical rate through a combination of observation and theory. The time scale comes from an understanding of how the carbon cycle works, and then that leads to a prediction for the critical amount. That amount is basically corresponds to on the order of 300 gigatons of carbon added to the oceans. Since the Industrial Revolution, we've added about 150. Any compilation or any prediction of how much will be added over the course of the present century suggests that at least another 150 will be added, and that would bring us beyond the predicted threshold.
So you are saying that in the direction we're going now, we are going to cross the threshold where a mass extinction event would be more likely.
Correct. And a more precise reading would say the following. Sometime during the present century, we will pass the threshold. We will effectively have crossed our best understanding of where a stability boundary in the carbon cycle might lie. And the question is, what happens next? Well, it turns out that the damping time scale of the carbon cycle is about 10,000 years, and so too would be the development of any instability within the carbon cycle. So that means that any deleterious effects that would be developing as a consequence of passing that threshold would play out over a long time. Now, what they would lead to and how fast they become, you know, serious is an entirely open question. So, I mean, we have no real conception of how this system works. This is essentially, at this point, an abstract idea of there being a stability threshold and the understanding that the other side would put us in a kind of unknown territory. But how that works is a subject of, you know, something that requires, you know, more research.
How are scientists going to use the work that you've just published?
Well, that's an interesting question. It's been out there on the internet now for 6 weeks, and, you know, things don't develop that fast, so I can't say, right? So let me see if I can answer you nevertheless. On the part of this scientist, I am motivated to use the empirical observations of this paper to devise a theory for what happens when you cross the stability boundary. I'm sure other people will be interested in doing the same, but there's another benefit or application or understanding of this paper that I think is important to impart. in earth science, there's a very active part of earth science which studies the past. People interested in climate science think of this as, you know, paleoclimate. But as a subject of basic science, it's basically one of earth history. You know, how did the earth develop into what it is today? How did life develop into what it is today? And how did the two co-develop? It's sometimes referred to as a co-evolution problem. In this coevolution problem, there is always the question of, okay, you have this event like the end-Permian extinction, which plays out over, you know, perhaps 60,000 years. It's between 10,000 and 100,000 years, right? How do we use that kind of knowledge to inform what is happening today over a period of centuries? So my paper provides a solution to that problem. And to me, that's been a very significant problem for some time, because geologically speaking, in geologic time, there's lots of changes, like the 31 changes I referred to earlier. But how they inform what's going on today has never been clear, because they're slow compared to the rapid changes of today. So I think, you know, if nothing else, my paper suggests that there's a new way of looking at the old events, you know, the events in the past, and extracting, you know, information of contemporary significance.
As an aside, I know you've done some research into the properties of carbon in storage. Do you think carbon capture and storage is a workable technology?
You know, it's going on now, and some people think it's successful. My own opinion is that it's a technology which should be considered seriously, because, you know, if you were to ask me, you know, how do we avoid the crisis that I'm pointing out as possible, well, there is a very simple suggestion, and that's to put less CO2 into the atmosphere. And among the many ways of putting less CO2 into the atmosphere is to bury some of it into the ground. And so, I mean, it's certainly something that should be considered.
And could you please tell us about the Lorenz Center and your own Rothman Group at MIT?
I'd be delighted to. Thanks for asking. So the Lorenz Center is a kind of climate think tank that I co-founded along with my colleague Kerry Emanuel. And our objective in founding the Lorenz Center has been to feature climate science as a curiosity-driven enterprise. We all understand that an understanding of climate is of huge practical importance, and, you know, the ways in which the climate may change, you know, has a profound impact on our lives and in successive generations. But in this discussion, it's somehow been lost that we don't really understand the system that well, and that we need to make predictions as well as we can, but there's more to this science than merely making predictions. There's also developing a better understanding. And the development of a better understanding comes from inspiring, you know, the best young people, the best minds in science, to come join the effort. And so what we've done at MIT is to create this center, the Lorenz Center, to attract people to this effort. And to do that, we're trying to seek private funding and to build an endowment. And it's also of interest to point out why we call it the Lorenz Center. The name Lorenz is the name of our late colleague Ed Lorenz, who is not only a meteorologist and a climate scientist, but perhaps best known for his development of the theory of chaos. And this is an interesting example in which a scientist interested in understanding the natural world around him, specifically the weather and whether it was predictable, made fundamental impacts that pervade all of science, because he was trying to ask under what conditions might one be able to predict the evolution of a system and under what conditions might one not be able to predict it. The not being able to predict category falls under the rubric of chaos, and it's had tremendous influence on science in general in the last half century. And we would hope to carry on that tradition by attracting bright young people to the world of climate science, in which they'll make contributions not only to climate science itself, but also to science in general. Within my own group, what we do is we basically apply mathematics to problems like these and to others, and we're particularly interested in the kinds of dynamical systems that Lorenz studied to such great profit.
We have been talking with Daniel H. Rothman, professor of geophysics and co-director of the Lorenz Center at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. His paper, Thresholds of Catastrophe in the Earth System, is open access, so you can read it for yourself. You can find links to that and much else that we've discussed in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Daniel, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Thanks very much for inviting me on the program.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Isn't Daniel Rothman a great scientific mind? There is so much to what he just said. I recommend you download or listen to that interview again. That's easily done from my blog for this week's show at ecoshock.org. You can play it right on the page, or you can download it and listen to it later. I am not a scientist, as you know, but I would like to discuss this interview with Dr. Rothman. These are my own opinions, and any errors are mine alone. Before we get to the nagging questions about what drives extinction, let me emphasize what may have slipped by in this interview. If I understand things correctly, in an earlier work, Daniel Rothman studied changes in microbial life at the sea bottom that can increase releases of carbon or methane. We all want to talk about asteroids or volcanoes or human emissions, things we can see. But large-scale changes may come about by forces unseen. Microbes may find our carbon loading as a new opportunity, whether at the sea bottom or newly thawed land in Canada, Alaska, and Siberia, the microbial world may intervene heavily in our history.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. But our guest Daniel Rothman is now publishing about very different things. As you heard in this interview, his new paper addresses a long-held theory about how climate change can lead to mass extinction. It has happened at least 5 times in Earth's history. The explanation often given, including by some guests here on Radio EcoShock, is that plants and animals are not able to keep up with the pace of climate change. Conditions change too fast, and species go extinct. Rothman tells us that is not the case, or at least not the primary driver of mass extinction. His in-depth studies of the carbon cycle going back hundreds of millions of years gives a different result. It is the amount of change that drives extinction, rather than the speed of change. That is a fundamental point, and it might reorient future science and perhaps public policy. But I am cautious about this result, precisely because Dr. Rothman is talking about one of the slow, grand cycles on this planet. Carbon is taken up by plants and then released as they die, and that's called respiration. The rate of respiration is not equivalent to carbon consumption, partly because some animals and plants sink to the bottom of the sea. Their carbon may rest there for centuries or much longer. It's like a leak in the carbon system. As a result, there's a huge amount of carbon held in the deep sea bottom, much more than found in the atmosphere. My understanding from this interview is that when thresholds are reached, microbes at the sea bottom can change towards releasing more carbon or even methane, which is many times more potent as a warming gas. But this change in the carbon cycle, Rothman says, is not instant or even likely in coming generations. Studies of past extinction events reveal that when a threshold is reached, the process change may not trigger a global event until perhaps 10,000 years later. This is not the stuff of the near-term extinction crowd. But then Rothman says, we don't really know how the carbon system works. Despite a century of scientific study and concentrated work in the last couple of decades, we still don't know, and that is very dangerous. At least with this study, Rothman is able to tell us what the threshold is. The level of carbon that could trigger the big slow release can be measured in gigatons of carbon added to the ocean. He says 300 gigatons of carbon added to the seas would do it. We've added 150 gigatons since the Industrial Revolution began, and most scientists expect we will put the other 150 gigatons in the seas by the end of this century. My take on this interview is that by the year 2100, we will indeed reach the trigger point for a release of those deep ocean stores of carbon. But the impact may not be evident for a very long time. If the carbon cycle change takes 10,000 years, it is like saying, when humans first started farming, we began climate warming. That was 10,000 years ago or so. Of course, there are scientists who say that is true. Agriculture began a slow climate change. But in this case, the result 10,000 years later would be mass extinction, a situation humans would be unlikely to survive. It's like a long-term curse on the distant future. Meanwhile, right now, we are running a whole new experiment with atmospheric chemistry. The rate of our addition of carbon is unheard of. Even conservative reports by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change say we won't have to wait long for climate disasters to become the new normal. My uneducated guess is that we are facing multiple processes. There is a very long-term cycle involving deep-sea carbon reserves, but everything else I get from climate science suggests there are also fast-moving operations which can destabilize weather, remap the coastline by the end of this century, and sooner than that. We need to know a lot more about fast and slow climate drivers and the relationships, if any, between them. We'll just have to keep going with research and radio EcoShock until we get it. But already, there is enough evidence in the melting poles, record set, and continuing disasters to demand rapid decarbonization. In the words of a recent idiot, do something.
Radio EcoShock.
The rainforests of Indonesia are up for grabs. Never mind the indigenous people or the wild animals. Step right up and clear it all away for palm oil. You just need a shell company or two and bags full of money for local governors. That's the sad story coming out of the island that used to be called Borneo. It's all laid bare in some great investigative reporting from Monga Bay and the Gecko Project. We have the Indonesia editor for Monga Bay on the line, Philip Jacobson. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, it's great to be here, Alex.
All right. You know, Phil, we only have 30 seconds to explain why this matters to listeners in other countries, including North America and Europe. Please tell us how Indonesia at one point became the world's third largest source of greenhouse gas emissions.
Sure. Indonesia has one of the highest rates of deforestation in the world. And this is a major contributor to global climate change. Indonesia also has the most peatlands in the world. And this is a sort of carbon-rich landscape. And these are also rapidly being converted into oil palm plantations and also timber plantations. So all of this is fueling climate change.
When I started monitoring Indonesian news for a big organization in the late 1980s, it was all about logging and deforestation. When did palm oil plantations hit the scene?
Palm oil really exploded in Indonesia in the 2000s. There were some experiments with large-scale oil palm plantations in the previous decades, but it really took off after the fall of the dictator Suharto in 1998. So after he fell from power, there was this massive decentralization of power from the central government to the regions. And as part of this decentralization, Indonesia's district chiefs, the head of its districts all across the country, were given all kinds of new powers, especially over natural resources. This included the power to hand out permits for oil palm plantations and also to mine coal. So what we saw happen in Indonesia was widespread abuse of these powers by district chiefs, who are known as bupatis in Indonesia. And this is at the root of why Indonesia has lost so much of its forest cover in recent years. And it's what we look at in our article, The Palm Oil Fiefdom, and also in other articles in the series.
Yeah, your description of how the bupatis took economic power into their own families reminds me of the formation of the Russian oligarchs after the Soviet Union fell in the early 1990s. But originally, this was an attempt to put more democracy out of Jakarta and into the other parts of Indonesia, wasn't it?
Exactly, yeah. It was supposed to make government more accountable to people. So Indonesia had just come off of the 32-year New Order dictatorship, which was presided over by Suharto, who is often, you know, he's called the most corrupt leader in modern history in the world. His family stole billions of dollars from Indonesia. And as you said earlier, a lot of that was based on logging the rainforest. So, you know, Suharto would hand out a logging concession to a company owned by a crony of his. And there were all kinds of corrupt schemes that his family participated in. But, you know, this decentralization was intended to, it was sold as a way of countering that and actually making these local governments more accountable to people. But what actually happened was the corruption was simply moved down through the system to the local level. And today, Indonesia's district chiefs or bupatis are seen as some of the most corrupt officials in the country. I think it was the interior minister of the previous administration came out with a figure that like some more than half of all bupatis in the country were linked to corruption scandals. And it often has to do with natural resources. Indonesia has incredible natural resources, whether it's timber, minerals, or just land, which can be used for oil palm plantations.
Well, let's talk about this palm oil. What is it used for and how do they make it?
Palm oil is used in many, many products that we find at the grocery store, that we find in, you know, convenience stores. It's in snack foods, it's in frozen pizza, it's in ice cream. It's used as a cooking oil in the developing world, especially Indonesia, India, I think China. It's used as a biofuel in Europe and increasingly in Malaysia and Indonesia as those countries try to prop up palm oil industry by increasing their biofuel mandates, and especially also as Europe lowers its mandate because of all the environmental problems that people are now realizing are associated with these plantations. You know, there's a statistic that it's found in like half of the items on supermarket shelves. I don't know if that's true, but it speaks to the ubiquity of palm oil in our lives. And as far as how it's made, so it starts off on these plantations or farms from the oil palm tree. So they grow the oil palm tree, and then they harvest the fruit of the tree. They send it to a mill. The mill turns the fruit into crude palm oil, and then that crude palm oil is taken to a refinery where it is turned into any number of chemicals that then are used in, you know, consumer goods or biofuels or whatever it is.
Right. I heard some Dutch companies were burning the palm oil as a green biofuel, but now we know it's not really so green. I think they've cut back on that. Now, Monga Bay and the Gecko Project have just published the first of a four-part series called Indonesia for Sale. What is the title and the focus of the first piece?
The first piece is called The Palm Oil Fiefdom. In this story, we hone in on one district called Serian. This is a district in Borneo, which is Asia's second largest island. It's an island shared between Indonesia, Malaysia, and Brunei. And it's where the palm oil industry has really expanded in recent years. The article looks at the bupati, or the district chief, whose name is Darwan Ali, and the permits he gave to oil palm plantation companies when he was in charge of the district for 10 years from 2003 to 2013. What we found is that Darwan's family and cronies set up shell companies, little no-name companies, to obtain permits from Darwan Ali, and then they immediately flipped these shell companies and the permits to major palm oil firms for a lot of money. So what it looks like is an elaborate and coordinated scheme to abuse, you know, his power as the bupati and his power over these permits. And then what happened in the places where these companies received land, and not all of them were ended up being developed, but some of them were, they caused all kinds of environmental problems, polluted the environment, grabbed people's land, destroyed the forest, fueling climate change. The story really looks at what happened when he was in charge.
Okay, so what happened to the local people, the indigenous people who lived in those areas that were just sold off to somebody, maybe a billionaire in Indonesia or a Malaysian a rich person or a corporation like, well, Pepsi or Unilever?
Sure. So the companies that we looked at were sold to two multinational firms. There was the Triputra Group, which is owned by a billionaire Indonesian family, and there was Wilmar, which is owned by a Malaysian billionaire family. So the Wilmar concessions were not developed, but three of the Triputra ones were. So the people living around these company concessions, they resisted. They didn't just sit back and watch these companies take their land. In many cases, they might have protested, they might have sent letters to their local governments, and then that didn't work because the guy who's running the district, what it looks like is the guy who's running the district, Darwin Ali, is in league with these companies. So he didn't lift a finger to really stop them from just taking their land. So people then took direct action. They blocked company roads. They, sometimes they burned down. I don't know if this happened in Sarayan, but it happens often in the country. Is they attack company offices. And what happens at that point is the company will bring in the security forces. So they'll call the riot police. They'll, sometimes the military is around. And, these security forces typically side with the companies. And, some people try to run for local office. We talked to a guy in Sarayan who ran for the local parliament. Each district has a parliament, but he said, I couldn't really do anything because Darwin Ali, his party, just controlled the parliament. What ended up happening in that district was, Darwin presided over it for 10 years, and there's 2 5-year terms, and you can't run for a third term in Indonesia. There's term limits. So what he did was he tried to install his son as his successor. And, the people of Sarayan just wanted no part of this, and they organized against this guy. And there were these two independent candidates who ran on, a campaign squarely aimed at the palm oil industry. And they ended up winning the election. And it was the first time in that province that an independent candidate actually won Bupati's election. So it really goes to show how much these people in the district didn't want this guy's family to keep running it.
The article, The Palm Oil Fiefdom, is detailed and it names names, and I'm thinking about activist deaths in Brazil or prisons in the Philippines. I wondered how you can go back to Indonesia. Can you?
Well, I hope so. Darwin Ali is just a district chief, so he's not, at a higher level than that. But, we do have other stories in this series, and I guess we'll just see how that goes. I worked with, Indonesian journalists as well on this series. I worked with the people at the Gecko Project on this series, so it was really a team effort. And, it's something we thought about, but at the end of the day, we decided it was more important to get this story out, and that's how we'll continue to approach the stories in this series.
Well, Indonesia used to be a pretty bleak place. I was there in 1993 in Jakarta, and if Time magazine did an article about Indonesia, it was just totally blacked out, blackened on the page, if you could find a foreign publication at all. So it's really loosened up quite a bit, and I know that there are good Indonesians who are struggling to preserve that fragile democracy. I've been told, I believe by you or by someone, that the president of Indonesia has read your new article, so there may be some hope that this will help get a fairer system in the long run.
Yeah, that's what we're hoping. This kind of corruption over natural resources is something that was overlooked for a long time in Indonesia. The country has an anti-corruption agency. It's called the KPK, and it's the most respected institution in the country. In a place where the citizens perceive their government as being so corrupt, the KPK is seen as clean. So for a long time, the KPK just went after big fish in Jakarta, right? Like ministers, the leaders of political parties, that sort of thing, in the national capital, Jakarta. And, it's really under-resourced as part of the reason, but it wasn't really looking at this kind of corruption out in the rural hinterlands of the country until recently. What we're seeing now is that the KPK is reviewing both coal mining permits and oil palm plantation permits on a massive scale. They're reviewing these permits for any illegalities that might be associated with them. Maybe they were issued unprocedurally. Maybe the companies aren't paying their taxes. This stuff is really, really common. So the review of coal mining permits started 3 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, and they've revoked like hundreds of permits. The palm oil review is now a year old, and we'll see what happens with that. It could be that they start revoking permits there too. They've also arrested a Bupati in eastern Borneo, and who's infamously known as the Queen of Coal because of how many coal mining permits she's handed out. So that was a really kind of a landmark arrest because it was the first time they'd arrested a Bupati for handing out permits without actually catching them in the act of taking a bribe. So the KPK can do that. It's just a lot harder to put together a case like that, which we examine in this article, because if you look at Darwin Ali, the Bupati of Sarayan, he presided over a much more complex scheme than simply, you give me a bag of cash, I'll give you or your company a permit. Right, using his relatives and cronies to set up shell companies, which they used as vehicles to make money from palm oil firms. Yeah, I mean, this kind of thing is, you know, Darwan is not an outlier. This kind of thing happens all over the country. The Bupati that was arrested in eastern Borneo, the Queen of Coal, you know, there's been some journalism about family connections with some of the companies that she's licensed. There's been other indications that the thing is happening in many districts. You know, the Sarian is just a really egregious example, which is why we chose to focus on it for the first story in our series. But it's something that is really pervasive in the palm oil industry and really at the root of all the problems that it is singled out as causing.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith. My guest is Philip Jacobson, an investigative journalist and the Indonesia editor for MongaBay.com. We're talking about converting the rainforest into money, basically. Would you tell us about the environmental impacts of growing palm oil in these giant agribusiness operations?
The first thing I'll say here is that there's nothing inherently wrong with palm oil, right? It just happens to be a really profitable commodity. And so big companies are, and also smallholders, small farmers, are clearing, but mainly big companies, are clearing lots of land and planting this oil palm crop on a massive scale. So, you know, it's the kind of thing that happened for hundreds of years with various different crops. It could be sugar cane. It could be beef in, you know, South America now. It's just a profitable commodity, which they want to plant on as much land as they can. As far as the environmental impacts, one of them is pollution. These companies often ignore rules that prohibit them from planting right up next to a waterway. In Sarian, that was the case. And there's a lake in the heart of Sarian district. It's called Lake Simbulu. And if you swim in that lake, it's itchy. I swam in it, and I came out. I was itching a little bit. So, you know, it's been polluted with all kinds of effluent from these, you know, palm oil is a really high input crop. You need a lot of fertilizer and stuff, and this kind of stuff seeps into the water system. So that's a big problem. And then you see fisheries collapse. So that's something that I've heard that from all kinds of communities that I've visited throughout the country is pollution of waterways. And it's not really a national issue in Indonesia, but it is something that, you know, I think will become one if these communities continue to speak up. So there's that. There's also the burning of peatlands. So Indonesia is replete with these carbon-rich peat swamps. And oil palm companies, when they ran out of land on mineral soil to plant, they turned to the peatlands. So to plant a peatland, you've got to drain the soil, because it's really waterlogged, and oil palm trees don't do well in waterlogged soil. So what you do is you dig a trench through the soil, the water table lowers, and then you can plant it with oil palm. And it's not as good as mineral soil, but it's something. You can still run a plantation on that. But what happens is when you drain the soil of water, it gets really flammable, and it burns really easily. And peat is it's decomposing organic matter. And, you know, if you leave it there for like a million years or whatever, it often turns into coal. So you know how coal fires burn forever. Peat fires are incredibly difficult to put out. The layers of peat can stretch for meters and meters and meters below the surface, so the fires can spread underground. So you've got the drainage of peatlands. And on the other hand, you've also got companies and farmers using fire to clear land for planting, which is the cheapest method. It's a lot cheaper than using a bulldozer. So, you know, you've got plenty of indigenous communities that have been doing this kind of Sweden agriculture for generations, and they can actually often do it sustainably, you know, on a really small scale. But there's also all kinds of transmigrants within the country that might not know how to do it in the traditional way. You've got companies doing it illegally. And so the fires often burn out of control on these desiccated peat swamp landscapes. And so the fires in Indonesia have become such a massive issue, and they burn almost every year. 2015 was one of the worst bouts of these fires that the country has ever seen, and the emissions from these fires are just astounding. You know, for the 4 months that they burned in 2015, you know, they emitted more emissions than the entire EU economy. Indonesia is one of the leading greenhouse gas emitters, and most of its emissions come from deforestation and the burning of peatlands, you know, as opposed to the U.S. or China, where the emissions are coming from the burning of fossil fuels primarily. So that's a massive problem.
Yeah, there's the smoke. It's a health hazard for the people of Indonesia, but also it drifts all the way over to Malaysia and Southeast Asia. I've seen satellite pictures of that smoke, and it's massive.
Oh, yeah, and it goes farther than that. You know, I think the smoke in 2015 got as far as Guam and, you know, Korea, and even some people say it even got as far as Madagascar. There were traces of it.
Wow. And it's just in the news that a new species of orangutan has been discovered in Indonesia. What have you heard about that, Phil?
Yeah, that's true. It's called the Tapanuli orangutan, and there aren't very many left. It's in Sumatra, and yeah, the government is, you know, has to figure out how to protect that orangutan if they don't want it to go extinct. So we actually ran a story on that recently, both on the discovery and also on what the government plans to do about it. So it was heartening to see some environment ministry officials talk about the need to protect this orangutan. There's also been similar statements from the governor of North Sumatra province where the orangutan was discovered. So hopefully they follow through on these commitments that they're making, and the animal doesn't go extinct.
Are there protected nature areas in Borneo, and are they really protected?
There are protected areas. There's national parks, there's forest reserves, but Indonesia has a very hard time protecting these areas. You know, deforestation is continuing in these areas. Law enforcement is pretty nil. So, you know, if we think about climate change, studies are showing time and again that one of the best ways to protect an area of forest is to recognize the rights of the indigenous communities that live around that forest, that use that forest, whose culture is kind of based on that forest. There's a lot less deforestation in these kinds of areas. So there's a big indigenous peoples movement in Indonesia right now, and one of the goals of this movement is to try to secure the rights to their land. Similar things are happening in other countries, but the Indonesian movement is particularly strong. So what we saw at the beginning of this year was the president, Joko Widodo, who's known as Jokowi, he recognized the rights of 9 communities to their forest lands, and he rezoned these areas as what's called a customary forest area. So it's a very strong protection for these communities. And, you know, the Indigenous Peoples Alliance in Indonesia, it's an organization, is pushing for, you know, vast areas of the country to be rezoned, even as companies are also kind of competing for the same land. So, you know, the global land rush is happening all across the world, and it's, you know, it's happening in Indonesia too, and we're seeing it play out with all kinds of implications for the environment, for animals like the newly discovered Tapanuli orangutan, and for people like the people in Serian who stood up to Darwin Ali and prevented him from installing this kind of a dynasty in the district.
So looking at this from the outside, how can we in international society help turn palm oil from a destroyer into something better?
Sure, that's a great question. So it's really interesting to think about how the international community can address these issues in a place like Indonesia. You know, there's all kinds of commitments being made by giant corporations who use palm oil. They're saying they're not going to source palm oil that's connected to deforestation, to land grabbing, to labor abuses, to other human rights abuses, or to peatland conversion. You know, in practice, all of these commitments, they all have targets that are at some point in the future, so they're still using all this kind of palm oil. What they say is they're still trying to trace their supply chains to actually figure out where their palm oil is coming from, because it's a tremendously complex supply chain, right? If you're Unilever, for example, and you're making, you know, consumer goods that we find at Walgreens or whatever it is, you know, you're buying refined chemicals from a refiner who buys palm oil from a miller who buys the palm oil from, who buys fruit from a guy with a truck who buys that fruit from another guy with a truck who gets it from a plantation. So, you know, they're still trying to trace out their supply chains. Nobody's been able to get past the mill level. So, you know, I don't know how effective these commitments really are at this point. I mean, they have, you know, I think it really comes down to the government of Indonesia has to, you know, prevent this stuff from happening. It really has to enforce the law. It has to create strong policies and then enforce those policies. So I think that anything the international community can do to help strengthen democracy in Indonesia is going to further those goals. And it sounds rather vague, but, you know, there's a great example from a place called Aru that I like to cite, where the international community really came to bat for a local Indonesian movement that and it helped save a large area of land from being converted into sugarcane plantations. And, you know, the people there did not want this to happen at all, but there was this giant company that was, you know, had these concessions from corrupt government officials. So what happened there was it was in a place called the Aru Islands. And this is an archipelago in eastern Indonesia, and there's all kinds of endemic species, birds of paradise there. It's a really beautiful place. Several languages are spoken by the people there. And what happened was there was this company called the Manara Group, which obtained concessions for sugarcane plantations, and these concessions covered 70% of the entire Aru archipelago. So they were essentially proposing, and more than just proposing, they were, you know, intending to go through with this plan to, you know, convert almost the entire place into sugarcane plantations. And there was immediately there was a local movement that arose in opposition to this, you know, because the people there, they didn't want any part of this. And what happened was it became an international sort of a movement, especially on social media. There was this hashtag Save Aru, and you had all these different groups of people across the world, you know, lending their support to what was going on the ground. And there were all kind of protests on the ground by the people of Aru. A lot of Indonesian celebrities got involved. It started to kind of get a lot of media coverage. And there was a lot of, there was some investigating that was being done into these permits that this company held for the sugarcane plantations. And there were all kinds of problems with these permits. And it got really messy for them. And eventually the central government, the forestry ministry, allowed these concessions to expire. And the developments, you know, they didn't go ahead with these developments. So, you know, we're going to profile this in one of our stories in the series. And actually, the same company is still kind of poking around in Aru and also kind of doing a similar thing elsewhere in the country, although it's not getting as much attention. But that's one way that's just an example of how, you know, the international community really played a role in really saving the rainforest in Aru.
Do you have videos or photos about all this for our eyeballs?
We definitely do. So in addition to the print articles that we are producing as part of Mongabay's collaboration with the Gecko Project, we also have tons of photos and short films. So these are being put out on social media, on Facebook and Instagram, on the pages of both Mongabay and also the Gecko Project. So it's really high-quality stuff. I encourage people to go check that out. It adds to the print stories. And there's also graphics and illustrations, you know, maps and diagrams showing how these schemes work. We really thought a lot about how to communicate all this to, you know, the general reader, because it does get very, very complicated. But I do think that in the Palm Oil Fiefdom, we did a pretty good job of sort of simplifying everything in a way that people can understand. And the multimedia plays a big part in that.
As we wrap up, for those who don't know, can you briefly tell us what Mongabay is and then what the Gecko Project is?
Sure thing. So Mongabay is an environmental news site that's been around for like 15 years. It was started by a guy called Rhett A. Butler, no relation to the actor who was in Gone with the Wind. And he started it as his personal blog. And over the years, he eventually turned it into a nonprofit and started applying for grants and funding from foundations and donors and turned it into a bona fide organization. So today we have 28 million readers. I think it's per year. You know, I sometimes mix up these statistics. Our outreach guy sent me a bunch of statistics. But, you know, we have dozens of correspondents across the world. Four bureaus. There's Indonesia, Latin America, India now, publishing in local languages, as well as the English site, which I'm with. And I work closely with the Indonesian Bureau, which is staffed by four Indonesian editors. And also they have a network of freelance correspondents throughout Indonesia. So we're growing and growing, doing more investigative work like this. And we are collaborating with the Gecko Project, which is an initiative of the UK-based nonprofit EarthSight. And the stories that we're collaborating on, we're calling the series Indonesia for Sale. So it's been really great to collaborate with them. I think we each bring unique capabilities to the table. And it's really exciting to do this kind of work that exposes a kind of corruption that everybody in the development world in Indonesia and the people who are working on these issues like deforestation, you know, everybody kind of knows that this is going on, but it hasn't really been articulated until now. And I think we're really laying it bare with the series. So I encourage people who are interested in how corruption drives climate change to read the series.
Well, I read the first article. It's several pages. I couldn't stop. It's one of the best pieces of investigative journalism I've read in a long time, and it really took me straight into the heart of that part of Indonesia and the issues. We've been talking with Philip Jacobson. He is the Indonesia editor for the environmental group and Power News site. It's a huge Mongabay. They've just published the first in a blockbuster series in one of the world's biggest land grabs, the palm oil industry of Indonesia. Check it out at mongabay.com or thegeckoproject.org. Phil, thank you so much for alerting us to all this.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I enjoyed talking to you.
I'm Alex Smith reporting for Radio EcoShock. That's it for Radio EcoShock this week. I hope you have left the table full and ready for action. Thank you for listening. I'm Alex Smith.